Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your listening post for politics, Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We are glad you are with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we go again. Welcome.
Action-packed Monday, Dennis.
Oh, there is plenty to talk about tonight, so let's get right into it. First, we will acknowledge off the top of this broadcast that there are reports the FBI has searched former President Trump's home in Palm Beach, Florida today. Now, this is a story that literally broke only minutes before we hit air live on this Monday night, so we don't know anything more about it. So we can't comment on it, but we likely will have plenty to say about it next week. That's next week. Now for our top story tonight, abortion, not because of something that happened here in Iowa, but it happened in Kansas. Yes, Kansas. Pro-choice advocates won a major victory last week in Kansas, one that may very well have repercussions in Iowa and across the nation. Laura, let's break it down. What happened in Kansas?
So the Kansas legislature had put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to coincide with the primary election there. And it was similar to what has been proposed in Iowa. We basically say there is no right to abortion protected by the Kansas Constitution, because the Kansas Supreme Court had ruled in 2019 that there was a fundamental right to an abortion in the Kansas Constitution. And this thing was expected to be very close. And instead, it was a blowout where the vote against this constitutional amendment had almost 59%, and the vote for the amendment was just a little above 41%.
So is it fair to call this an earthquake?
Yes, absolutely. And even the people running the no campaign in Kansas were not expecting anything like this kind of a victory. I saw the campaign manager, Rachel Sweet, gave some interviews last week, and she said, you know, before an election, they had a meeting where they talked about some messaging and what they were going to say in the event of a close win or a close loss, or they even thought it was possible they would lose by a significant margin. But they didn't even discuss the message for this kind of huge double-digit victory, because they weren't expecting that.
So in the wake of the decision last week, New York Times had a story that said Republican candidates are, and I'm quoting now, softening their once uncompromising stands against abortion as they move forward toward the general election, recognizing that strict bans are unpopular and that the issue may be a major driver in the fall elections. And I think certainly what we've seen in the last few days with Republicans across the nation, this is true. I think they have been shocked by this.
Yes. And Iowa Republican candidates, even before this, you could tell from their social media feeds, they were posting a lot about the southern border, about inflation, about gas prices. They really have downplayed their stances on abortion over the summer. They did welcome the Supreme Court ruling in the Dobbs case in June. But generally speaking, I think Republican candidates were trying to keep the focus on other issues. And that last week's result in Kansas just ensured that that's going to continue.
Okay, let's cross the state lines. Let's talk about possible lessons for Iowa. Number one lesson that you wrote about this week or last week, the abortion issue might drive up turnout.
Yes, so the Kansas legislature scheduled this vote to coincide with a primary election when presumably turnout would be lower than a general election. But in fact, they had turnout that was on par with what they would get in a general election, more than 900,000 people turning out to vote, a record for a primary.
Another lesson might be that a lot of Republicans, maybe more than we think, really don't want to ban abortion, because this got some Republican votes.
It clearly did. It's a little bit difficult to tease out, but I was reading a lot of analysis of the Kansas vote. At a bare minimum, about 20% of the Republicans who turned out to vote in the primary, the GOP primary, must have also voted against the constitutional amendment. More likely, it was closer to 25%, because we assume that some Democrats and some independents probably did vote for the constitutional amendment. And there were a lot of counties where Donald Trump won by enormous margins in 2020, and yet the constitutional amendment either didn't carry the day or won by a narrow margin. And just to give people an idea, Kansas is a little more Republican leaning than Iowa. Trump carried Kansas in 2020 by about a 56 to 41% margin. About 15 points. He carried Iowa by about a 53 to 45% margin over Biden, so about an 8-point margin. So Kansas is definitely a red state, and that's one reason why people were just not expecting this to go down. There were probably at least 20% of the people who voted just came out and voted on this constitutional amendment and nothing else. So those were the unaffiliated, the no party voters who didn't participate in either party's primary, but they were motivated to come out and vote.
And we often talk on this broadcast about the difference between city voters and rural voters. And it seems pretty clear after what happened in Kansas last week, abortion bans are toxic in the suburbs.
They are, and especially in the suburbs. There were just enormous, Johnson County in Kansas, it contains a lot of the Kansas City suburbs. It's very similar to parts of Polk County and Dallas County, Iowa. And this is an area that was rock solid Republican for many elections, swung toward the Democrats in the Trump era. And it was just a massive 2-1 result for the no vote on the constitutional amendment in Johnson County, Kansas, which is very populous. So I think that you will see a lot of candidates running in the suburbs. So that's Representative Cindy Axne in the 3rd Congressional District, but also a lot of the Iowa House and Senate Democratic candidates running in suburban districts are going to be talking about this abortion issue and how Republicans in Iowa have already voted to ban abortion and may do so again.
We know that Republicans would really like to amend Iowa's constitution to make it clear that to restrict abortion. Might this vote in Kansas give them second, third, or even fourth thoughts about trying to do this?
I asked a lot of people that question last week. I noticed that Representative Stephen Holt, who's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and he was the floor manager of the constitutional amendment in 2021, he was a little bit equivocal when he talked to the Des Moines Register. He said, well, we have to think about what's our priority and whether we need to do this. And we might, depending on how courts rule, we may try to pass the 2018 law again, what they call the heartbeat bill and what some people call a 6-week ban. So it sounded to me like there is some disagreement. Now, I also heard from people that within the pro-life community in Iowa, there are still people who feel it's very important to push for this constitutional amendment. So I think there will be pressure within the Iowa House and Senate Republican caucuses to keep pressing ahead. But there may be people in the caucus who don't want to take that vote. I think they probably will have the votes to pass the amendment in the House and Senate, but it's a big gamble for them.
So where does the governor come down on this? She's quick to often talk about things that happen in other states. I don't believe she's talked about this.
I have not seen a comment on it. I don't believe she has had a press availability. And also, it just so happens that in the constitutional amendment process, the governor doesn't have a role. This is just something that the Iowa House and Senate would pass and to get it on the ballot. The governor doesn't need to sign it or anything. So I think that she will probably sidestep this issue. And most Iowa Republican politicians haven't had a lot to say about what happened in Kansas.
I doubt that we're going to see Governor Reynolds with a TV ad talking about abortion.
Not likely. Very unlikely.
Right. Okay. While this was going on, there was a decision late last week that may have surprised a lot of people. Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union announced they are giving up their fight against an Iowa law mandating a 24-hour waiting period for abortions. We should say that Planned Parenthood has been following that 24-hour waiting period, but they're giving up their lawsuit. So this is complex, Laura. Simplify it for us. What happened here?
So if you remember the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling in June where they overturned their own precedent about whether the Iowa Constitution protects the right to an abortion, it was this case. They were not deciding the case on the merits. They were deciding one part of this case, and it was a challenge to the 24-hour waiting period. So they sent it back to the lower court. They said, we're not setting a new standard for how we evaluate abortion restrictions, but we're just saying that there is no fundamental right to abortion under the Iowa Constitution, and you can go back and fight about it in lower court. And so what was bound to happen if this litigation continued was whatever the outcome was in the Johnson County District Court, it would be appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court, and then they would eventually decide whether to uphold this 24-hour waiting period or whether to strike it down. And then they would also set a new legal standard for how they look at abortion rights and abortion restrictions. So the risk here is that the Iowa Supreme Court was certainly not going to strike down this law. I mean, you could see from the way the opinions came down in June, there is no way that there would be a majority saying this law should be struck down. Probably only one of the remaining justices would have done that. So to push ahead, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Iowa would have been running the risk that the Iowa Supreme Court could have come down with a precedent that was very detrimental to their side that would say, for instance, that abortion regulations are just subject to what's called a rational basis review. That's a very easy bar for the government to clear. So they felt that instead of moving forward and likely losing this case in the Iowa Supreme Court, if they drop it now, it could be years before the Iowa Supreme Court rules again on abortion. And possibly that kind of ruling wouldn't happen until after Iowans have already voted on a constitutional amendment.
So this was a strategic move to try to fend off a negative Supreme Court decision.
Yes. And I mean, it was clear from the news release that Planned Parenthood is upset about the 24-hour waiting period and the impact that that is going to have on patient care. The ACLU mentioned that in many cases, this leads to a delay of much longer than 24 hours, but they just felt that they need to focus on fighting possibly a constitutional amendment and also fighting this battle that may be coming up in court where the governor is trying to reinstate that 2018 law that would ban most abortions after about 6 weeks.
So what sometimes gets lost in all of the hoo-ha, which is what I call the screaming and the yelling, is that no matter what's happened, abortion remains legal in Iowa.
Yes, it is still legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks. The 24-hour waiting period is in effect. There's an ultrasound requirement as well, but abortion is still legal in the state of Iowa.
Who would have guessed that people would come to Iowa from other states in order to get an abortion?
Right.
And yet that appears to be happening.
Yes. Yes, it is.
All right. Well, while this is happening, a report last week that while abortion remains legal in the state, there were fewer of them last year than in 2020. So let's deconstruct that.
So abortion in Iowa had been declining for about a decade from 2008, where it hit a peak, to 2018. And then in 2019, there was a big jump of 25% in the number of abortions. And then from 2019 to 2020, another big jump, a 14% increase, which was quite striking. So this year, this summer, the preliminary numbers came out for 2021, and it said that there was a decline overall of about 7% between that 2020 number and 2021. The decline, I just today got the breakdown from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services about state Iowa residents and out-of-state residents. And the decline was more significant in people coming from other states to have abortions in Iowa, but there was still about a 6% decline in the number of Iowans having abortions. And there is a lot of discussion and debate about what might be driving that.
Right. Planned Parenthood says one thing, anti-abortion folks say another. Nobody really knows what's going on.
Nobody knows. And another thing that's different now from in the past is that some people are able to access drugs that induce a medication abortion through the mail. And so it's possible that there could be more people self-administering abortions at home. That would not be reflected at all in the official statistics.
So while all this was going on in Kansas, President Biden last week jumped into the abortion debate again. He signed an executive order to help ensure access to abortion.
Yes. I mean, the idea was to protect travel from one state to another state where abortion is legal. I think that there are still a lot of questions about how people's medical records might be accessed, whether people could be subject to prosecution in their home states. And I think that this is going to be a murky legal area for the next few years, probably. But that was the intent of the president's executive order, certainly.
And one more sidebar on this before we move on. You reported last week that the state Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board may soon clarify whether state laws on attribution statements apply to some kinds of political text messages. Now, this was part of what played out in Kansas late in the abortion campaign.
Yes, because I was following that Kansas campaign closely. And on Monday, the day before the election, thousands of people received text messages that didn't disclose who paid for the message. And it made it sound like voting yes on the amendment would protect women's health and give women a choice. That was the wording. When, of course, a yes vote was a vote to remove any abortion rights from the Kansas Constitution and allow the legislature to ban abortion. So it was kind of the opposite of what the text said. So my first question was, is this possibly legal in Iowa? Because we have a vote coming up this November on a very contentious gun-related constitutional amendment. And of course, we may vote on an abortion constitutional amendment within the next 2 years. So I checked with Zach Goodrich, who is the executive director of the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board. And I learned that unlike in Kansas, where they have different rules for regular elections with candidates and ballot initiatives, Iowa does not distinguish. So in theory, Iowa law on attribution statements for campaign advocacy does apply to advocacy for or against a constitutional amendment. However, it's not clear that the ethics board has never weighed in specifically on whether text messages need to have that kind of attribution statement. And he had also been following what had happened in Kansas, and he plans to be drafting an advisory opinion to address this that the Iowa campaign regulator may vote on as early as next month.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and let the audience do it as well. It is 15 and a half after the hour, wherever you're listening to us, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa and sometimes elsewhere. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and we're here every week at this time to talk about politics Iowa style, how it's affecting all of us. We never seem to run out of things to talk about. We always seem to have to rush because there's so much going on. That's what makes us happy, that there are things going on that we can talk about. Democrats last week passed a big climate tax and healthcare bill in the U.S. Senate. The House expected to pass it this week. A gigantic victory for Democrats, for President Biden. Let's talk about it. Oh, by the way, every Democrat voted for it. Every Republican, Chuck Grassley, Joni Ernst, voted against it. Let's talk about it.
Yes, and the Vice President, Kamala Harris, had to break the ties. She had to break a lot of ties during that debate. This was a surprise. This was almost, it reminded me, Dennis, of one of your favorite topics, the bottle bill. Because This thing seemed like it was dead. This is the skeleton of what last year was called the Build Back Better bill. This is the big bill that would address healthcare and climate change and a few other things that the Democrats were trying to pass through what's called the budget reconciliation process, where you don't need 60 votes like most legislation. You only need 51 votes. And they, of course, have 50 seats, and they have the vice president to break a tie if everybody's there. And so this thing, the main sticking point has been West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, and to a lesser extent, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema. And Manchin had said a few months ago, basically, that this thing was dead. And yet, all of a sudden, in late July, it seemed that he made a deal. And so this is not everything that the Build Back Better bill would have included, but it did have a lot of provisions that affect the energy sector, a lot of climate change. This is the most significant climate change legislation that would ever reach a president's desk, and a lot in terms of agriculture, solar tax credits, carbon capture. I mean, just an enormous bill. The main thing that's missing from it that would have been in Build Back Better were some of those, the social spending, the child care subsidies, the child tax credit. Those types of things are not in this bill, but it is still an enormous step and a big victory for the president.
As we say, it includes a new minimum tax on big corporations, provisions to lower prescription drug prices, $300 billion to address climate change, more than that. But things had to be cut, as you have indicated here. And one of those things involved insulin prices.
Yes. So the Senate, there are a lot of arcane rules in the Senate. So to go through this reconciliation process where you only need 51 votes, it has to be directly related to the federal budget. And so a person called the Senate parliamentarian goes over these bills with a fine tooth comb to make sure that nothing in it would violate that rule. And so late last week, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that a provision that would limit copays, monthly copays for insulin for people who have private health insurance, it would have set that limit at $35. And that was ruled to be not directly related to the federal budget. Whereas other things like allowing Medicare to negotiate for drug prices and things related to insulin prices for people who are on Medicare or Medicaid, that does directly affect the federal budget, but not this private insurance provision. So what the Democrats did, instead of taking it out of the bill right away, they left it in the bill. And then a Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, during the debate, when this part came up, he objected and said, this is a violation of this rule. So then there was a vote where you did need 60 votes to overcome that hurdle, and they could only manage 57. The 50 Democrats plus 7 Republicans voted to keep that $35 insulin copay measure in the bill. But Iowa Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst did not vote to keep that in the bill.
No, and you were going to mention a couple of words involving describing Senator Grassley's move on this. What were those words, Laura?
So there was a little bit of kabuki theater going on.
Kabuki theater.
Because everybody knew this was one of the big points that Democrats were talking up in the bill, the insulin prices. And so Republicans were able to offer a lot of amendments. Democrats were able to offer a lot of amendments to the bill. But to keep the package together, the Democrats were voting en masse against all of the amendments, even the amendments that they liked. Even Bernie Sanders had an amendment to extend the child tax credit, and everybody was voting against it because this would blow up the whole bill. So a Republican Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, he had a more limited provision on insulin prices. It would have limited insulin out-of-pocket prices for people who are either uninsured or are on high deductible insurance plans. And this failed on a 50-50 vote, with all 50 Republicans voting for it and 50 Democrats voting against it, and the vice president not breaking the tie. And so this allowed Chuck Grassley and other Republicans to say, hey, I voted for lowering insulin prices, when in fact, the only way to do that that was going to ever be part of this bill was the provision that was already written into the bill. So that's why I say it was a little bit of the kabuki theater. But in that case, and Senator Grassley's office has really been pushing back against the criticism, and they've been trying to remind people as much as they can that he did vote for a different provision that would have lowered insulin prices.
We always like to be a source of education on this broadcast, and so we take a moment to say that kabuki is a form of classical theater in Japan known for its elaborate costumes and dynamic acting. I don't know that I've ever seen the senator acting dynamically, and I don't know what costume he was in.
Yes. Well, he did get up and give a floor speech on Saturday afternoon just about this very point. So they knew that this was going to be something. It's a sensitive issue for a lot of people. If you think about the how many millions of people have diabetes, it's a very, very common health condition.
Yes.
And the insulin out-of-pocket prices have gone up so much in the last 10 or 20 years.
And I was just having fun with you, Senator. All right. Do climate experts think this bill is going to make a difference?
Well, I've been talking to people in the environmental community, and the opinion is really divided. So there were people who felt that this Food and Water Watch, the Center for Biological Diversity, they are not thrilled about the climate provisions of this bill. Other environmental groups welcomed the bill and said that this is a very important step. So there were trade-offs made that support the fossil fuels industry, and that was necessary to get Joe Manchin, who is a senator from a coal state, on board. And that was one of the main reasons that this bill didn't get over the finish line last year. And so I don't know. It's hard to generalize. I saw a lot of concern within the Iowa environmental community that the incentives for agriculture and the incentives for carbon sequestration could push forward the proposed carbon dioxide pipeline projects across Iowa, which the environmental community doesn't want. So a little bit of a mixed bag, but it's definitely the most significant climate legislation that the Senate has ever passed. If it gets through the House on Friday, as it's expected to do, it would be the most significant climate legislation that any president has ever signed.
And you mentioned the carbon capture pipelines. There are three proposed for Iowa that would crisscross the state. Summit Carbon Solutions on Monday outlined a series of parcels they may have to use eminent domain on in four counties if they cross those counties. We'll talk more about this next Monday night, because this is a very big deal in Iowa with a lot of people opposed to this, and we'll see how that plays out. All right, this is going to cost some money to do this. Where's the money going to come from?
A lot of different places. So there are tax provisions, and that was where the tricky negotiations were coming over these tax provisions. So some minimum a tax rate for corporations. And I saw Richard Lindgren, who was a retired business professor from Graceland College in Lamoni. He was saying, you can tell that this is significant because of some of the corporate complaining about the fact that they are going to have to pay taxes on the amount that they report to their shareholders and not the amount that they report to the IRS. And sometimes in the corporate world, these amounts can be very different. So it could be very significant. There were some tax provisions that the Democrats wanted to include in the bill that had to be taken out at the last minute because Senator Sinema, the Democrat from Arizona, objected to those, and they couldn't afford to lose even one Democrat. But There are really a lot of different, there are a lot of moving pieces to this, but it is going to be a deficit reduction act. That's the way it's been scored. It will actually reduce the deficit over the long term. Instead of a lot of big bills, the Build Back Better program would have added some spending to the federal over time. It would have added to the federal deficit and debt, but this bill should reduce the federal debt.
So we have about 4 minutes left. I want to go over a couple of other things that are important. The U.S. Senate passed a veterans bill last week, expanding health care and disability rights for millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. Now, both Republican Senators Grassley and Ernst voted for it, but this only after Senator Ernst had objected to a budget provision there.
Yeah, speaking of arcane rules in the Senate, so this was a bill that had passed earlier in the year, but there was a mistake in it. There was a tax provision, and tax bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. They can't originate in the Senate. So that's why they had to have a do-over on this thing. And so when it had passed the Senate earlier, both Iowa senators voted for it. But when it came back to the Senate, it happened to come to the Senate floor for a vote shortly after Senator Joe Manchin and Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced that they had a deal for a budget reconciliation bill. And so 25 Republican senators who had voted for this bill in June flipped their votes and voted against it and stopped it from reaching the president. And this is a priority for President Biden because he believes that his son, Beau Biden, that his fatal brain cancer may have been caused by exposure to burn pits in Iraq when he was serving over there. So it's a very big priority for him. And Senator Ernst, when the bill passed last week, her statement didn't acknowledge that she had briefly been against it. She said that she had always been for it. She said that Republicans said that there was a provision in it that they wanted to change. It was related to the funding. But that was no different from how it had been in June. The only change between June and the bill that came up in late July was the fact that they had taken out this tax provision. So I think there was a little bit of trying to save face for Republicans there. They got a lot of bad publicity for delaying the passage of that bill.
Saving face is different than kabuki theater, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And Chuck Grassley did vote for that. Every time he had an opportunity, he voted for it. He definitely did not want to be on the other side of this burn pits. And veterans groups, I have been fighting for this for years.
Couple of minutes left. We want to talk about Senator Grassley on another issue here. He said last week he thinks, he hasn't announced officially, he's going to support proposed changes to the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And that would clarify rules governing presidential elections and the counting of electoral votes. There's a serious weakness in the Electoral College Act of 1887 that Donald Trump tried to exploit in the 2020 election.
Yes, I mean that bill in itself, in the late 19th century, was a compromise that many people have criticized as not very well conceived. And so this is a bipartisan bill. One thing that it does is to make clear that the vice president's role is purely ceremonial. So the vice president would not be able to unilaterally and not accept electoral college votes from any one state. Also, under the current law, just one member of the House or one member of the Senate can object to a state's electoral slate, and this would greatly increase the hurdle. So you'd need 87 House members or 20 senators. And of course, they did get more than 87 House members to object to the electoral votes from Arizona and Pennsylvania, but they did not have 20 senators on board for that after the 2020 election.
So to pass this in the Senate, the Democrats would have to hold everybody and gain 10 Republican votes. Nine Republicans were part of this bipartisan compromise on the bill. Grassley could be the 10th. This could come down very interestingly.
He could, but this could be one of those bills that ends up passing with far more than 60 votes. If everything goes okay, I think there are still some fine details that they may be adjusting in the bill. But I expect that once people know this bill is going to pass, it'll probably get a very large majority.
Laura, it has been a whirlwind on this broadcast. And again, our top story was that there was word that the FBI has gone into Donald Trump's house, Mar-a-Lago, down in Florida, opened up a safe and apparently pulled some things out. We don't know more than that at this hour on Monday night. I'm pretty sure we're going to talk about it next Monday night, probably at the top of the show. What else are you looking for this week, though?
Well, I'm still looking for signs about what Iowa Republicans are planning to do on this constitutional amendment. I'm working on a few state government stories, but there is just a lot going on. Everybody is talking about this abortion issue. And like you said, near the top, the Kansas referendum was an absolute earthquake.
An earthquake. Absolutely. When, by the way, do you expect to see some TV ads coming out for the campaigns?
Soon. I mean, maybe even in August, but certainly by Labor Day.
Okay, we are out of time. Take care, will you?
Yes.
You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back in this same time slot next week, we promise, when we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style, and we hope you can join us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, go ahead, have a safe, healthy, and happy week.